From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. With such films as Meet Me in St. Louis and American in Paris, Gigi and the Bandwagon, director Vincent Minnelli shaped the look of the great MGM musicals. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with film historian Stephen Harvey. He's curator of a Minnelli retrospective at New York's Museum of Modern Art and the author of a new book about the director. Also today, we talk with Randy Cohn. As a writer for Late Night with David Letterman, Cohn comes up with ideas like the Monkey Cam and the 360-degree rotation show. Cohn has a new book of comedy pieces. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Quincy Jones, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Oliver Stone's new film, Born on the 4th of July. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. The president met with reporters today for the first time since the invasion of Panama. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president said he was gratified by the precision and effectiveness of the military operation, but admitted to being frustrated that Manuel Noriega is still on the run. But he joked about the $1 million reward the administration is offering for information leading to Noriega's capture.
His picture will be in every post office in town. That's the way it works. He's a fugitive drug dealer, and we want to see him brought to justice. And if that helps, if there's some incentive for some Panamanian to turn him in, that's a very $1 million that I would be very happy to sign the check for, yes.
The president said the government of Guillermo Endara is taking charge, making appointments, and starting to govern the country. He said his administration will feel obligated to try and help the Endara government in every way possible. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
A Spanish photographer was killed and an English photographer was injured during a crossfire between U.S. troops at the Marriott Hotel parking lot in Panama City. The photographer worked for Spain's largest newspaper, El País. A correspondent for the newspaper who was there said six journalists were standing in the parking lot when a U.S. armored personnel carrier was seen approaching. Other American troops inside the hotel apparently thought the personnel carrier belonged to Panamanian forces, and they yelled at the journalists to get out of the way, then opened fire. The personnel carrier briefly returned fire. The man charged with 27 counts of murder in connection with the nation's worst drunk driving accident has been found guilty of reduced charges. Charles Peskowitz reports from Carrollton, Kentucky.
The jury here in Carrollton, Kentucky has found Larry Mahoney guilty of 27 counts of second-degree manslaughter, several charges of wanton endangerment and drunk driving. That in connection with the head-on crash on Interstate 71 18 months ago. Mahoney was driving his pickup the wrong way on the highway when he hit the school bus head-on. 27 people, mostly teens and children, died in the fiery crash. The church bus was returning from a day at an amusement park north of Cincinnati. Mahoney's attorneys through the case had argued that it was faulty bus construction that caused the bus to burst into flames. For National Public Radio, this is Charles Peskovitz in Carrollton, Kentucky.
At least 32 people have been killed in the crash of two buses in Australia. Police say it is the worst bus accident in their country's history. The collision occurred when the two coaches hit head-on on a highway on the coast of New South Wales. Romanian President Nicolae Ceausescu sent tanks and troops with submachine guns firing into crowds of demonstrators in Bucharest today, according to reports from foreign journalists. A Yugoslavian journalist in the closed country, Petar Tomic, said an armored vehicle crushed two students. And when others rushed to their aid, security forces opened fire, killing and wounding a number of others. American diplomats counted at least 13 dead and believe more casualties were possible there. This is NPR News in Washington. The Midwest is in the grip of record-breaking cold with below-zero temperatures and high winds producing dangerous wind chill factors. Mark Minnelli of member station KWMU in St. Louis has more.
Forecasters are saying this could be the coldest December since they began keeping records. Temperatures have hovered around 5 degrees below zero all day, with northwest winds producing wind chills of close to 40 below. Meteorologist Ben Abel says it's going to get worse before it gets better.
We're expecting the temperature tonight to bottom out at about 15 below zero, and when you combine that with a wind speed of, say, 20 miles per hour, we're talking wind chills of 60 below.
In addition, all barge traffic on the Mississippi and Missouri rivers has come to a halt due to a combination of low water levels and ice in the channels. Some relief is predicted for the Christmas weekend, with forecasters saying Christmas Day may even see temperatures rising to the freezing mark. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Minnelli in St. Louis.
Florida citrus growers are bracing for the icy arrival of this winter on the anniversary of a freeze that killed more than 100,000 acres of citrus trees in 1983. A spokesman for Florida Citrus Mutual, the biggest growers organization in the state, said growers were extremely concerned because the forecast holds the possibility of a freeze. The forecasters at the National Weather Service said freezing weather is expected throughout most of the state over the Christmas weekend. South African authorities let Nelson Mandela talk by telephone with exiled leaders of the African National Congress for the first time during his 26 years in prison on Tuesday night. The General Secretary of the ANC told Reuters in an interview Thursday he was one of those who spoke with Mandela. The number two official in the outlawed organization said Mandela did not discuss his possible release, but that he, Alfred Nzo, doesn't think South African authorities can afford to hold him much longer. Nzo is the acting leader of the ANC, while its president, Oliver Tambo, recovers in London from a stroke suffered in August. I'm Bill Redlin, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is currently running a retrospective of the films directed by Vincent Minnelli. My guest Stephen Harvey is the museum's associate curator of film. He's also the author of the new book, Directed by Vincent Minnelli. Minnelli was one of the most stylish directors of his day. Between the years 1943 and 1976, he made 34 films, among them the musicals Cabin in the Sky, Meet Me in St. Louis, An American in Paris, The Bandwagon, Brigadoon, Gigi, and Bells Are Ringing. His melodramas include The Clock, The Bad and the Beautiful, Lust for Life, Some Came Running, and The Sandpiper. And he also directed the comedies Father of the Bride, Designing Woman, and The Courtship of Eddie's Father. In the 1950s, Minnelli married one of his leading ladies, Judy Garland. Liza Minnelli is their daughter. Minnelli was under contract to MGM for 26 years and made all but three of his films there. I asked Stephen Harvey if Minnelli helped define the now classic style of the MGM musical.
Yes, he certainly did, because first of all, he came along to MGM in the early 40s at a time when the great producer of musicals, Arthur Freed, was really hitting his stride. And so their collaboration is really largely what we think of when we think of the MGM musical. Also, it was a sort of quirk of timing in that Technicolor was really only coming in for the first time in general use in the studios by the early 40s. And he was somebody who really thought in terms of color, because as a set designer on Broadway in the 30s, he'd really sort of reshaped the way the Broadway Revue looked in terms of bold use of color and so on. And he was able to adapt that talent to the screen. And so a film like Meet Me in St. Louis, which was his first color film, his third film, really sort of, not revolutionized quite, but certainly changed the way color was used. It was used, you know, to really express emotion, to express a particular period of, as the film was set in turn of the century, Midwestern America, and he wanted to really use the colors that were that would have been used in a Victorian house of that period. From then on, really, the MGM musical's fortunes were linked largely to Minnelli and to Arthur Freed.
What sets apart his musical production numbers from other production numbers of the period?
Well, one of them is, again, the enormous attention he paid to decor. He was notorious, Minnelli, when shooting films to sort of hold up shooting for days at a time while he rearranged the look of the film. And as someone who had started as an art director, the decors, the colors, were much more important to him than directors like, for example, contemporaries of his like George Sidney or Charles Walters. The other thing was his use of the mobile camera, because the use of boom shots, tracking shots, to sort of underscore the rhythms of the music and the dancing was something that he really developed in a much more sophisticated way than any other director before or since. So there's an extraordinary sense of mobility in his production numbers. You look at the American Paris Ballet, for example, or the Dream Ballet in Yolanda and the Thief, or the Dream Ballet in The Pirate. And they're very mobile and very cinematic, in which the main character, the dancer or the singer, is just one object in his direction, and part of this sort of organic scene, not just the focal point, but part of his decor.
My guest is Stephen Harvey, and he's the associate curator in the Department of Film at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and they're running a retrospective of Vincent Minnelli's films. And Harvey's just written a book called Directed by Vincent Minnelli. One of Vincent Minnelli's movies that's always very popular this time of year is Meet Me in St. Louis,
yes,
which stars Judy Garland, and it's become something of a Christmas movie because the climax happens at Christmas time,
yes,
and she sings Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Indeed, yes.
This was one of the few movie musicals of its time, one of the first really, to have the songs integrated into the story. Why was it so unusual then?
Well, actually, basically the making of Meet Me in St. Louis was engendered by two stage phenomena, basically. One was the success of Oklahoma, which again is considered, not entirely accurately, but to a certain extent it's true, as the first really integrated Broadway musical. And again, a musical set in the American past, in which the songs are sort of interwoven as closely as possible with the plot. And the second popular stage phenomenon was Life with Father, again, a nostalgic domestic tale of an American family, more or less at the turn of the century. And the success of these two plays on Broadway sort of influenced MGM into thinking that they could make something of this sort. You know, the irony is that in some ways Meet Me in St. Louis has proved even more enduring, certainly, than Life with Father.
You also say it was very unusual to show a typical American family in a musical,
exactly.
Where most musicals are more show busy,
exactly.
About people on the stage and screen.
Precisely. The musicals, 9 times out of 10, musicals were about, well, Mickey and Judy putting on a show, whether on Broadway or in their backyard or whatever. It was considered sort of too difficult before Meet Me in St. Louis, really, to do a musical in which, without a backstage story, because it would be too implausible to have these interludes of music interrupting a story. And Meet Me in St. Louis was one of the first, you know, to do this really successfully without a show business context.
Vincent Minnelli had to convince Judy Garland to star,
yes,
in this movie. Why was she so reluctant?
Well, by that point, Judy Garland was about 22, 23 years old, and she was still playing 17-year-olds. And in fact, in Meet Me in St. Louis, she's, Esther Smith is 17 and at one point cries, "I've waited all my life to be a senior." And so Garland was really tired of playing that sort of part. And so she just, for that reason alone, she decided that Meet Me in St. Louis was not what the kind of thing she wanted to do. She wanted to play grown-ups. And so at one point before production started, she called Minnelli, whom she really, really scarcely knew at that point, into her dressing room at the studio and said, "Well, it's really not very good, is it, the script that we've been handed?" And Minnelli said, "Oh, no, you're quite wrong. It's very good indeed." And when she expressed her dismay, he basically convinced her that together they could make something special out of it, which they did. And in fact, this was the making of Meet Me in St. Louis. It was the start of their romance. A year after the film was completed, they were married.
Well, this was a period when Judy Garland was having a lot of troubles with barbiturates and other drugs, a lot of problems with anxiety and insecurity. And here she was being directed by her lover and then husband. What was it like for him to direct her during that period?
Well, actually, the real problem started later. Even the problems with barbiturates, as I understand it, really didn't completely develop until a couple of years later. Meet Me in St. Louis was a relatively tranquil shoot for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequently, the next year, they made The Clock together, which was apparently a very, very happy shoot. And during a period when she was, in fact, trying, you know, not to depend so much on barbiturates and so forth. The real problems occurred later on, even between them, with the making of the musical The Pirate, which was shot in 1947. After they'd been married, after the birth of their daughter Liza, and one of the problems there was that, you know, Minnelli really was in effect a kind of Svengali to her Trilby, and that he was, with the series of films they made together, he was trying to sort of make a more mature artist out of Garland, and I think on a certain level she welcomed that very much, welcomed that attempt, but also perhaps resented it. And during the making of The Pirate, their personal relationship and professional relationship really did clash quite a bit. And it was a very long shoot, 6 months, partly because of Garland's difficulties. And their marriage after The Pirate was never quite the same either. And they separated a couple of years later, then divorced in the early 50s.
Well, in fact, when she was signed to do the musical Easter Parade, Vincent Minnelli was supposed to direct her, but her psychiatrist, you say, suggested that he... Not do the movie.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And it, in a way, it shows Minnelli's, you know, sort of total dedication to work, which, you know, extended to a kind of tunnel vision, that it had never occurred to him after the problems on The Pirate that Easter Parade would not be a good idea as another collaboration. I think probably her psychiatrist was quite correct.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the films of Vincent Minnelli. My guest is Stephen Harvey, who's the associate curator of the film department at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. They're showing a retrospective of Minnelli's films, and Stephen Harvey's just written a book called Directed by Vincent Minnelli. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about the MGM movies directed by Vincent Minnelli, and my guest is Stephen Harvey. One of Minnelli's best-known musicals is An American in Paris, which starred Gene Kelly. An American in Paris ends with the now-famous, I think it's 17-minute ballet sequence, to
yes.
Gershwin's composition, An American in Paris. What was Vincent Minnelli's approach to staging it? And I should say here that the choreography was done by Gene Kelly.
Yes. Well, you know, again, basically the idea was to incorporate, you know, ideas from Impressionist paintings into choreography and dance and emotion. And, you know, Kelly's responsibility was the choreography, and while Minnelli's was the sort of overriding concept. And, again, you really see there what I was talking about earlier in the sense of his camera mobility sort of adding to the emotion of the music and of the dance. And also, you know, he had always been someone influenced very much by painters. He had studied painting at the Art Institute of Chicago when he was young. And when he was a set designer in the theater, many of his sets, you know, sort of incorporated ideas from the painters of that era, people like Magritte and Dali and so forth. And so basically here he was doing the same thing 15 years later, you know, with the Impressionist painters. And that was his, you know, his great contribution. The sense of color, the use of color is really extraordinary in the movie and in the ballet, rather. And the seamlessness with which it goes from one movement to another through this, you know, sort of moving camera of Minnelli, it's really quite astonishing still, I think.
The Bandwagon, a musical directed by Vincent Minnelli, starring Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse, was made in 1953. And to my mind, in a way, this was one of, like, the last of the great musicals.
Yes.
I wonder if you feel that way, too.
Well, I do agree, actually. It's certainly, except for Gigi, it's his penultimate great musical, Minnelli's. One of the things I love about The Bandwagon is that, apart from the extraordinary variety of musical numbers, is that it sort of exemplifies certain themes of Minnelli movies, many of his movies, not just the musicals, but the melodramas as well. One of the themes that comes up over and over again in Minnelli's work is the necessity for work, that work is the thing that motivates you and that gives you fulfillment in life. And also, underneath the sort of sophisticated, even gaudy surfaces of these musicals, what makes Minnelli's musicals distinctive is that there's almost always an undertone of melancholy in them, and that's also certainly true in The Bandwagon, which is the story of a sort of has-been Hollywood star who is beginning to lose his self-confidence in his own powers and then gradually regains them through adapting his talents to a Broadway play with a whole new group of collaborators. And there's a lot of melancholy in the movie, specifically at the beginning, towards the beginning, Fred Astaire's wonderful solo to By Myself, the Dancing in the Dark duet between him and Charisse. And this is a quality that Minnelli brought, you know, really just about all of his musicals, and that I find very interesting.
The duet that Astaire and Sid Charisse dance to Dancing in the Dark takes place in Central Park, but it's really a soundstage.
It certainly is. They never go outside in that movie. It's all done at the studio at MGM. It's not even done on the outdoor back lot. All of it is done in soundstages.
Now, I think a lot of movie makers today are paying homage to Minnelli in a way by getting an almost hallucinogenic soundstage look, you know,
yes.
an almost super realist look by going with the soundstage instead of going out into reality.
No.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, it's true. It's a tendency that started among a number of filmmakers in the 70s, people like Scorsese and Coppola.
Yeah.
And, you know, these were people who really grew up on these movies and reveled in their artificiality, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny because at one point I remember we were showing some Minnelli excerpts for a program at the museum several years ago, and Scorsese was there, and so was Liza Minnelli. And one of the sequences we showed was from The Bad and the Beautiful, in which Lana Turner has a nervous breakdown in her car, and it was all done on a turntable. It's very artificial and very dramatic and exciting. And Liza Minnelli was standing there, and she realized that it was basically the same scene as she had filmed in New York for Scorsese, which she has a fight in a car with Robert De Niro when she's on the verge of giving birth, actually, in the film. And so she turned to Scorsese and said, you know, boss, I didn't know you took that from Daddy's movie. And Scorsese totally deadpan said, of course I did, you know. And this is something, and also Coppola with movies like One from the Heart certainly have imitated that sort of deliberately artificial style. And also a lot of music video. A lot of music
mm-hmm.
video has, you know, sort of gone back to Minnelli production numbers and you know, you sort of use them as inspiration.
Did Minnelli have a choice? Could he, for instance, have shot that Dancing in the Dark number in Central Park, or Did he have to do it on the soundstage?
Well, in that period, in the late 40s and the early 50s, it was very unusual to go on location and very expensive and very complicated. In fact, there had been some talk of making an American in Paris, in Paris. There had been some talk of that, and up to about a month before shooting started, they were considering it very seriously. But then as one of the art directors on the film, Preston Ames, said to Kelly, you know, have you ever danced on cobblestones? And that was one of the things that sort of scotched that, was that it was considered sort of too complicated to shoot musical numbers, you know, in real locations. But in the early 50s, it really wasn't possible. And Brigadoon was another film where there was some talk of shooting it in Scotland, but because of weather conditions, they decided, in fact, that it had to be done on a soundstage. And there were times when Nelly welcomed that, because, again, for the American in Paris Ballet, there was really no need to go to Paris because it was about Impressionist art, not really about Paris per se. And it was really easier, indeed, to recreate those on big cycloramas, those canvases on big cycloramas at the studio. Something like Brigadoon, he would much have preferred to shoot on location. And actually, from the mid-50s on, more location work was done, not so much for musicals, but Gigi is one example of a film that was shot largely in Paris instead of on the soundstage. And, of course, the look is very, very different as a result.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Harvey is my guest. He's the associate curator in the film department at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where they're now running a retrospective of Vincent Minnelli's films. And Stephen Harvey has also written a new book called Directed by Vincent Minnelli. Why do you think in the 1950s the classic Hollywood musical kind of starts its downward slide?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One is that, in fact, music was changing. Popular music was changing with the advent of rock and roll in the mid-50s. And also, you know, I think the great stars of the movie musical, the classic movie musical, were getting older. I mean, Astaire by this point was in his mid-50s. Even Gene Kelly was in his late 40s by the mid to late 50s. Judy Garland was in decline, at least in terms of her her acting career. And so, you know, the performers were waning somewhat, and again, the musical style was changing. Also, it was becoming more and more expensive to make these films by the mid to late 50s, and with all movie audiences dwindling because of television, and the movie musical especially, because young people really preferred rock and roll, there was sort of less of a demand for them. So that was really, I think, the reason. And by the late 50s, most of the movie musicals that were being done were either adaptations of sort of pre-sold Broadway hits, or something like Gigi, which was the closest thing to it because it was conceived and written by Lerner and Lowe, who had done My Fair Lady, and in effect it was My Fair Lady with a French accent.
Did Vincent Minnelli ever have the sense that he was working past his time?
Well, I think that was true perhaps in the 60s, not in the late 50s with the musical so much, but by the 60s, the whole studio system, which had nurtured him, really was falling apart by then, and it was very hard for him to conceive of a professional life without that army of technicians that he had relied on to sort of realize the look that he wanted on film. So I certainly think by the mid-60s, he was aware that the kind of movies he made, the kind of relationship he had with the studio really were anachronisms.
We've been talking about Vincent Minnelli's musicals. He also made quite a few melodramas, including The Bad and the Beautiful, Some Came Running, Lust for Life. How much control did he have as an under-contract studio director at MGM? How much control did he have over the choice of which movies he got to direct?
Well, there were certainly movies that he turned down, things that the studio wanted him to do, which he didn't do. He never was on suspension for disobeying them. And once in a while, he was forced to do something he really didn't want to do, like the film version of Kismet, which was a musical comedy he really didn't like. And he was sort of blackmailed into doing it by saying, if you want to do Lust for Life, which was a project he really wanted to do desperately, first he had to shoot Kismet. But especially once the film started shooting, he had a great deal of autonomy on the set because MGM really trusted him. And so he was really given an awful lot of latitude in terms of the way he shot his films.
The Museum of Modern Art is running a retrospective of Minnelli's films. I'm sure you ran your own retrospective while writing your book.
Oh, yes, I certainly did.
Yeah, watching all of his movies over and over again. So what did you see in his films that you hadn't noticed before? What surprised you?
Well, again, one of the things was that while the musicals and the melodramas, you know, seemed so different in terms of subject matter, Minnelli's style sort of linked them together into a sort of coherent whole in the sense that, again, as I mentioned earlier, the musicals had an unexpected melancholy, and that became clearer and clearer to me as I watched them again. And the melodramas had the kind of visual vitality and the spirit that the musicals did. I mean, one thing one notices after a while with the melodramas, films like Home from the Hill and Some Came Running and Lust for Life, and Madame Bovary, his version of the Flaubert novel, is that a lot of them build up to a set piece, which is like a movie musical production number, in which, you know, the camera goes crazy and you know, and the decor glistens, and the main character has a kind of a personal epiphany. So in Madame Bovary, there's this extraordinary ball sequence, which is taken from the book, in which Emma Bovary, you know, sort of realizes for the first time that she has aspirations beyond her station. And the camera does these 360-degree whirls, and the dancers go crazy, and windows are shattered. And it's, again, like a musical production number, but it's in one of the melodramas. And it works within that context very well. There's a ballet in Brigadoon, in which one of the characters tries to escape. Brigadoon is chased through the heather and through the fields and forests, and which is very much like a sequence in one of his more stark melodramas, Home from the Hill, which is a boar hunt through the wilds of East Texas. So, and yet the style in which they're shot is really very similar.
Some movie musicals are about the conflict between pop and the fine arts. I mean, even The Bandwagon, you know, Esther is a kind of hoofer, a man of the musical, and Citcherise is a ballet dancer, very refined, and they think that they'll never be able to get along with each other. And in a way, you could say that that's the relationship that movies and museums have had until recently. Mm. Movies have been mass entertainment, popular culture, and museums kind of reserved for the fine arts. And now, you know, like in the Museum of Modern Art, there's a film department, there's film screenings. What do you see as the role of the museum in dealing with film?
Well, I think there are basically two roles. I mean, one of them is indeed to keep the history of film alive, and to keep it alive on film, by which I mean, you know, over the last 10 years with the video cassette revolution, you know, one can see old films in a way much more easily than one could have before. But to see them on a small screen is really not the way they were intended. And so, you know, some place like the museum is one of the last places left where you can see a 35-millimeter print projected on a big screen of old films. But also we have a second function, I think, which is to alert our public to new trends in movies and in film, with programs like our New Directors, New Films series, which we do every year, every spring, which shows the work of unknown, new directors. And so I think, you know, basically those are our two great functions. And I mean, among the other series that over the last few years that I've organized personally are sort of unknown films from, or lesser known films from Italy and France and so forth. We did a series on Anna Magnani, the great Italian actress, last year, which showed films of hers that had never been seen in this country before in some cases, or if they had, not in 30 years. And it's, you know, by major directors like Pasolini and Rossellini and so forth. So, you know, that's certainly one of the things that I try to do with the programs that I organize.
Well, Stephen Harvey, thanks for talking with us about the work of Vincent Minnelli. Thank you for your time.
It's a great pleasure.
Stephen Harvey's new book is called Directed by Vincent Minnelli. Harvey's the associate curator in the Department of Film at the Museum of Modern Art, and he's organized a retrospective of Minnelli's movies at the museum that will run through January 28th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be jazz guitarist Jim Hall. I hope you can join us. Here's Judy Garland, a song from the Vincent Minnelli film Meet Me in St. Louis.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Randy Cohn spends his days in the office coming up with wild ideas for David Letterman. Cohn has written for Letterman's late-night show for 6 years. Coming up, some behind-the-scenes stories. Also, jazz musician and arranger turned super producer Quincy Jones has a new album. It's the first album in 8 years that he's performed on. The music ranges from jazz to rap. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. And 3 years after Oliver Stone made Platoon, he's back with another film about the Vietnam War. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Born on the 4th of July. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Looting continued in the streets of Panama today, but the country's newly installed leaders took office and declared a nighttime curfew. David Adams in Panama City reports the new government also offered an olive branch to the followers of General Noriega.
The Endara government was received by the assembly members of the opposition, those who claim that they won the election on May 7th, which was annulled by General Noriega. Mr. Endara announced a new cabinet, naming his vice presidential running mates as Minister of Interior and Minister of Planning and Economy. He also announced three ambassadors, an ambassador to the United States, an ambassador to the United Nations, and an ambassador to the Organization of American States. There was also a curfew announced from dusk to dawn, and then a statement of principles and objectives of the government, followed by a series of offers of reconciliation with General Noriega's security forces.
U.S. troops continue cleanup efforts in Panama City, dealing with snipers and small bands of those loyal to General Noriega. Pentagon officials are concerned that actions by followers of General Noriega could force U.S. troops to transform their mop-up operation into a long-term guerrilla engagement. Noriega has still not been found, with some thinking he is still inside Panama City, and others believing he could be in the countryside or even out of the country. The bodies of four U.S. sailors arrived this afternoon at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The Pentagon says that 21 U.S. servicemen were killed in the invasion of Panama, and 208 others were wounded. Four others are missing. Terry Daniels reports from Dover Air Base.
Four naval SEALs were flown to the Dover Air Force Base on a C-141 Starlifter. The bodies of Lieutenant John Patrick Connors, Petty Officer Isaac George Rodriguez III, Chief Petty Officer Donald Lewis McFall, and Petty Officer Chris Thielman are the first American casualties to return to the States. Secretary of the Navy H. Lawrence Garrett III praised the men for giving their lives fighting for their country. Another plane is expected to arrive here at the Dover Air Force Base this evening at 8:15. The plane will be flying in from the Howard Air Force Base and will have another 12 casualties. For National Public Radio, I'm Terry Daniels, Dover Air Force Base.
So-called friendly fire between two groups of U.S. troops in Panama City yesterday left a Spanish journalist dead and an English reporter injured. It happened outside the Marriott Hotel when U.S. troops arrived to rescue Americans trapped inside. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 3 points to close at 2,691.13 on volume of some 175 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Quincy Jones is now one of the big men in the music business, but he started out in jazz in the late 40s and early 50s, playing for a while with Lionel Hampton and arranging for musicians like Ray Charles, Oscar Pettiford, and Dinah Washington. He went on to do everything from writing soundtracks to becoming a record company executive. Jones really hit big when he started producing Michael Jackson's solo albums. Now Jones has brought together musicians that reflect the scope of his career. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Back on the Block.
Sticks and stones may break your bones, but you ain't never felt the wrath of Quincy Jones. Hard to the core, an entrepreneur, and jams that he makes slam for you and your pleasure. As you listen to every measure, groove with the track as the cue gets fresher.
I've been away for a long time. Now I'm not only back, but I'm here to rhyme. So bust the move as I include that I'm back on the block portraying the dude.
So hey, young world, saying Quincy, Quincy.
The ambition and range of Quincy Jones's Back on the Block is pretty amazing. Jones seems to have conceived of this album as nothing less than a musical history of African-American music. Enlisting musicians like Dizzy Gillespie and Ice-T, Jones is attempting to touch bases ranging from jazz to rap with pure pop ballads in between. The album thus becomes the attempt of the 56-year-old Jones to prove that he's still on top of things.
Ice-T, let me kick my credentials. A young player bred in South Central L.A., home of the body bag. You wanna dive, wear the wrong color rag. I used to walk in stores and yell, lay down. You flinch an inch, AK spray down. But I was lucky cause I never caught the hard time. I was blessed with the skill to bust a dope rhyme. All my homies died, I caught the pencil. Lost the diamonds, cops told the benzos. Living that life that we thought was it. Fast laning, but the car flipped. I'm not gonna lie to you cause I don't lie. I just kick thick game. Some people say why? Cause I'm back on the block, I got my life back. So I school the fools about the fast track. I get static on my style and my technique. Profanity, the blatant way in which I speak. But the dude knows the streets ain't no kiddie game. You don't know the dude? Quincy's his first name. He told me, Ice, keep doing what you're doing, man. Don't give a damn if the squares don't understand. You let them tell you what to say and what to write. Your whole career be over by tomorrow night. Rap from your heart.
That's the album's title song, a rap performed not only by Ice-T, but also Melly Mel, Big Daddy Kane, and Kool Moe Dee. But the music behind the rapping suggests some of the eclecticism that Quincy Jones is aiming for. It's performed by musicians as various as Toto's Steve Porcaro, Weather Report's Joseph Zawinul, and pop session players Rod Temperton and Michael Boddicker. Two cuts later, Jones follows this up with a raucous duet between Ray Charles and Chaka Khan on I'll Be Good to You. As I hope is clear by now, Back on the Block is a very imaginative, very peculiar record. The musicians performing here have virtually nothing in common except for the fact that Quincy Jones likes them. Jones, who began his career 3 decades ago as a jazz arranger, bandleader, and producer, moved into the 60s with such an open mind that he oversaw the production of Leslie Gore's pop sob classic It's My Party. That was a huge hit that Jones has said both established him as a mainstream producer and brought him a lot of grief from his jazz colleagues. Jones went on in the 70s and 80s to produce albums for Frank Sinatra, George Benson, and Donna Summer, but most of all for Michael Jackson. The albums Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad were all supervised by Jones and thus associated him with such a massive superstar that Back on the Block can also be heard as his attempt to reestablish his independence from Michael Jackson. Jackson doesn't appear on this album, but his style is pervasive anyway. On various cuts, Jones employs El DeBarge, who sounds a lot like Michael, and Saida Garrett, who once duetted with Michael. Jones also showcases his new discovery, 12-year-old Tevin Campbell, who sounds a lot like the prepubescent Michael.
Oh.
Back on the Block is a bold record that's easier to admire than it is to enjoy. Jones's obsessive eclecticism leads him to things like a slavish cover of the awful jazz homage Birdland, and a showcase for the insufferable Bobby McFerrin on the coyly titled We Be Doin' It.
We got that rhythm, pumping up, a beat without a drummer. Tell me ain't it tough, we got a great big bottom. Getting down, got the only low bass, baby, when there ain't no bass around.
Oh, we can jam in the human beat. Come, let's go, everybody, to the acapella party. Be there, that's where we're doing it.
The virtues of Back on the Block are Quincy Jones's modesty. He's downright eager to eliminate any trace of a consistent style in his production job here, and also his open-mindedness. There's no other musician of his generation who's been so encouraging of the young rappers represented here. But ultimately, Back on the Block is an awkward affair, well-meaning but overblown.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for The Village Voice, LA Weekly, and Spin.
No melody. Got the secret key to you, baby. Let's make music, harmonizing ecstasy.
Come on,
come on, come on, come on, come on,
come
on, and sing it to me.
This is Fresh Air. Before Randy Cohn got a job as a writer on the David Letterman show, he was a freelance magazine writer. In the 6 years he's worked for Letterman, he's come up with such ideas as the Monkey Cam, the Overdub show, and the 360-degree rotation show. All the while, he's continued to write short fiction for such magazines as The New Yorker and Harper's. He's collected some of his stories in a new book called Diary of a Flying Man, but I wanted to know about the exciting life of a TV comic writer.
Every day you go into your office, it looks just like a tedious desk job, and you drink coffee and you read the paper and avoid actually doing your work as long as you can. Then anxiety kicks in, and you just try to come up with ideas that Dave can do on the show.
What's an idea you came up with this week that's going to be on?
I ran across a press kit for the Corey Haim, a young actor, very popular with the young people. He had just released his new video called Me, Myself, and I. It managed to combine fatuity and egomania in ideal proportions for humor, I thought, and called up the press agent, got a copy of the Corey Haim tape, pulled off the most ludicrous clips where Corey kind of lounges on a white sofa and petulantly describes his likes and dislikes, Corey on kissing, Corey on baseball. He likes both of them, by the way. And I'll show these to Dave, and Dave seemed amused, and he'll run them from time to time on the show, probably Friday.
So he's going to actually run the clips from the video?
Yeah, just Corey lounging on the couch. I think the way it will work is Dave will say, well, yeah, but I wonder what Corey would think about that. And we'll just see a little of it, and it will run without comment. And I think it's that Dave's attitude is so clear to our viewers that it will slather on just the proper dose of irony so that Corey will be really, really sorry he ever made this tape, and or maybe delighted, I don't know. But I do think it will run without comment so that there's very little possibility of litigation in this.
The thing that you just described with the Corey Haim tapes,
yes.
That's an idea, right? Do you
yes.
write lines for Letterman, or do you present him with a concept?
There's surprisingly little writing in any sense that anyone would recognize, in the sense of the deft use of language on the show. The pieces I've been most successful with, and I think the pieces that the show does the best, are giving Dave a situation in which he can be incredibly amusing. Monkey Cam comes to mind,
mm-hmm.
a piece of mine that I was endlessly delighted with. We had a chimpanzee named Zippy, as I believe they're all named Zippy, it's some sort of federal law, on whom we'd placed a tiny micro camera and microwave relay equipment so that Zippy could operate the camera. Zippy could telecast the entire show, and he was permitted to range free in the studio for an entire show.
How did all of this get started? The thrill cam, the monkey cam. There's so much playing around with cameras on the show.
I think a joke that Dave is real funny about is making a big deal out of a small thing.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of slathering on incredible technological sophistication to do a show as trivial as ours, which I think the underlying joke of from Dave's point of view is that isn't that what all TV is, you know, enormous squandering of technical resources.
Mm-hmm. Now, something else that's been a running theme for the past few years is squashing things and dropping things off tall buildings. This has been going on a long time. How did that get started?
It has. There's an element of the 12-year-old boy sensibility,
uh-huh.
things that a very smart but very unsophisticated kid would think was cool and it just runs through the show. I don't know how to explain it beyond that. I did a piece like this.
What did you do?
A couple of weeks ago, we went out to a wrecking yard in New Jersey and dropped a 3,000-pound block on a lot of stuff. It's childish. It's idiotic. It's destructive. It's mindless. And it just seemed incredibly funny. I don't know why.
Did it work on the show?
It was beautiful. It was beautiful. We had really, really good slow motion so that when you dropped a 3,000-pound block on a pyramid of GE fluorescent tubes, it was just unbelievably lovely. Do you remember the last 3 minutes of Zabriskie Point?
Yeah.
When they blew
everything
up?
Everything blows up in slow motion.
Yeah. Icons of consumer culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's as if the last 3 minutes of Zabriskie Point were the only good part of that movie, and that's what we decided to make our show about. It's our sort of homage to Antonioni.
Now, GE owns NBC now.
So they do.
And there's always little jokes about GE on the show, like, for instance, crushing the light bulbs. Of course, it's not exactly like hard-hitting commentary on corporate culture or, you know, or conglomerates or anything like that. But how does GE react to it? Are there limits that are set for you
by the
network executives?
No, they're not. And that's, I think, a little disturbing. It's certainly disturbing to me, and it's disturbing, I think, to Dave. I don't want to presume to speak too much for him about this, but if there were limits, it would mean that what we were doing was in some sense subversive and disturbed them. And there are not limits, and I'm afraid the effect of these jokes is perhaps to humanize them and to make them appear cute and what good guys they are, what sense of humor they have. It's a kind of American tradition of complaining about your boss, but it's largely contentless. Don't you think? I mean, we do make jokes about the lack of safety of General Electric products, and we do make jokes about GE as defense contractor, GE as builder of nuclear power plants or unreliable jet engines. But I don't think they're subversive.
Were you going to try it out sometime, do something that would truly be subversive and see what kind of reaction you get, if any?
Not my call.
Right.
Dave's call.
Letterman always reacts to viewer mail. And you see the letter on the screen, and the weird parts are kind of highlighted. And he reads it out loud, and then there's often a little fantasy that's enacted afterwards in response to the letter. Are those always real letters?
Yeah, they're always real letters. And no one believes it, and no one will ever believe it. It seems an insoluble problem that it's a comedy show, and it lacks credibility. Perhaps our lack of credibility is our greatest asset. I wish the president had the same lack of credibility. Would make him a better person. But the letters are all real, yeah.
One of the things you did with viewer mail was to have the Red Army Chorus sing a viewer mail theme.
It was a piece of mine to commission Henry Mancini to compose the lovely and moving theme to viewer mail. And it's wonderful. It's stirring. It makes viewer mail seem almost as if it were actually worth watching. And when I read that the Red Army Chorus was going to come to America, we arranged to have them come and sing the theme to viewer mail. And I felt if we could truly trivialize a significant event in contemporary political life, the opening of relations between East and West, the end of the Cold War, if we could make it truly trivial, we would have lived up to the standard set by network news.
Do you ever worry about an overdose of irony?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Do you ever worry about getting too ironic, about dwelling on the trivial for, you know, like having a lot of fun with trivial things, but for a really long time?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think that the Red Army joke was a trivial joke.
Uh-huh.
I think maybe the Red Army joke was a pretty serious joke. I mean, I'm not sure how to talk about it without sounding unbelievably pompous. But I thought the Red Army joke was a smart and serious joke about the way television, particularly television news, has the capacity to trivialize the most significant events of the day.
Was the Red Army Chorus in on the joke? Did they
yes,
know what they were saying? Yes,
they were really wonderful. It's humor from the Urals. It's they were given the lyrics and the music to the Mancini theme, and it was their idea to do a sort of medley from a song they sing called Kalinka that would segue into the viewer mail theme and then back to Kalinka. That was their notion, and it was very funny. It worked really well. And it was conceived by them to be funny. They were great.
Mm-hmm. Where are you while the show is actually being recorded?
In the makeup room, about 6 feet away from the studio. This is where we're invited to hang out, and this is where you get the only touch of show business glamour, that you're upstairs working in an office all day long,
mm-hmm.
and it seems like an office job. It doesn't seem like, there aren't a lot of people running around the halls saying wacky things. There aren't people playing jokes. It's a kind of a serious and reserved group of people. There's a sort of level, a constant undertone of anxiety, a sense of having to get things done by that day for that show. But at 5:30, you go downstairs, and there are trained circus animals and glamorous actresses, and it's wonderful.
I'm sure you don't need to be writing for magazines to supplement your income. Is one of the reasons why you're continuing to write pieces so that you have a life outside of your television life? A writing life outside of television?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just, it's a terrible thing to say, but I really enjoy writing them. And there, as we were discussing, there's not a lot of writing on the show that in the sense of the deft use of language. And
yeah.
This is another kind of writing that is just wonderful to do. And I've been lucky, and I now can write for wonderful places where they treat you with great kindness and respect and make you a better writer than you actually are.
Randy Cohn, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Randy Cohn's new book, Diary of a Flying Man, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, can you tell us about your coverage of Panama today?
Yes, we'll be hearing today about the U.S. Army's actions in Panama. Still, no move by the Army, it seems, into downtown Panama City to control the areas where there's been a lot of looting. Still, they have not found Manuel Noriega. But President Bush says he is very satisfied with the operation, although he spoke today at the White House about the problems of sustaining casualties in any military operation. We're also going to be hearing today about developments in Romania, where tanks fired on demonstrators today in the capital, Bucharest.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Oliver Stone directed Platoon, the Academy Award-winning film set in Vietnam during the war. Stone's new movie, Born on the 4th of July, stars Tom Cruise as a disabled soldier returning home. It's based on a 1976 memoir of the same name by Ron Kovic, who was a leader of Vietnam veterans against the war. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
There have been enough Vietnam movies by now for us to identify certain traits of the genre, and one of them is this: that, strangely enough, nearly every Vietnam movie tells the same story. And stranger still, like any great myth or like the stories of the Holocaust or of the Christian martyrs, the Vietnam story always works. It's about innocence broken by horror, about a young man who goes to Vietnam believing that he's fighting for America, stopping the communist scourge, carrying on the proud tradition that saved the world from Hitler and Tojo. Then he discovers that Vietnam isn't like the glorious American wars celebrated in the veterans' parades, that civilians are needlessly killed, that his own life comes cheap, that the cause is ignoble, and that, back home, nobody wants us there anyway. Underlying this central story is the idea that the kind of John Wayne jingoism that we were all brought up with is the very tendency that created Vietnam. and that the hypocrisy of that attitude was exposed once and for all by Vietnam's boggling immoralities and contradictions. To my mind, no movie has ever told this story more effectively than The Deer Hunter, made 11 years ago now. But here is Oliver Stone's Born on the 4th of July to tell it again. And again, it's undeniably strong stuff. In this version, the gung-ho young innocent is Ron Kovic, played by Tom Cruise. The Vietnam he faces is more sand than jungle, but it's still the familiar arena of horror, where civilians are needlessly slaughtered and where Kovic accidentally kills one of his fellow soldiers and then can't make anyone listen to his confession of guilt. Eager for punishment, Kovic gets sloppy and takes a bullet in the spine that paralyzes him below the chest. Back home, his family is sympathetic, but attitudes there are changing. Even his brother Tommy is asking, why are we in Vietnam?
You served your country. I mean, what'd you get out of it? I mean, look at you.
Look at me.
Look at you, man. I gotta go. I'll see you around, all right?
Look at me. What's wrong with me, Tommy? What's wrong with me? Is there something wrong with me? I volunteered, Tommy! You don't know what you're talking about! Where were you? Were you there? Were you there? You could just love it or leave it, Tommy!
You can hear some of the movie's problems in that scene, and some of the problems in Cruise's performance as well. His rattled patriotism has a canned quality. And as good as Cruise is in many of his scenes of anguish and self-doubt, he never manages to be convincing as the before-and-after picture Oliver Stone intends, because his patriotic before phase is a caricature, as is that of his family. Stone has always tended to hammer audiences over the head, usually with long, preachy speeches. Here he delivers blow upon blow, stating and restating the obvious, and doing so with the closest of close-ups, the flashiest of flash pans, the loudest groans, and the goriest gore. During Kovic's stay in a rat-infested veterans hospital, Stone rubs our noses in the filth and terror, and the palpable hell he creates is enormously effective. But he also rubs our noses in Mom, apple pie, and baseball during the movie's early scenes, and in the confusion of the anti-war movement later on. And though you get the message all right, you may wish that, metaphorically speaking, Stone would give your poor raw nose a break. Born on the 4th of July is a blowhard movie, an angry, prideful rant. It is also, inevitably, very powerful.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews. Our production assistants are Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sharrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the best guitarists in jazz, Jim Hall. And on the eve of the College Bowl game, sports writer Rick Tellender takes a harsh look at the big business of college sports. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.